Hello, thanks for listening to this episode of Map to the Stars. Before we start, we wanted to take this time to thank the amazing contributions of Sarah Helm and Jacob Anstey. They contributed the artwork and music, respectively, which truly helped realize the vision and aura of this podcast for Michelle and I. This project wouldn't be the same without their work, and we're so grateful. We love you guys. Anyhow, we're just so excited to share this with the world. Right, Michelle?
You bet. We're so excited and eternally grateful for Jacob and Sarah.
Absolutely.
And Sarah and Jacob. We love you guys.
Yeah. You're the best. They're the best. You're the best. And thanks for listening. You're the best. So here are more of our voices. We hope you don't hate it. See you soon. Hi, welcome to Map to the Stars. My name's Jeremy.
And I'm Michelle.
And this is the podcast where we look to the stars abroad in Hollywood and the stars above in the sky. It's my tagline. That's very wordy. Do you like it?
He's demoed this for me.
I've said it in my sleep for 2 months straight. As your filmy chartographers, we'll be diving deep into and comparing and contrasting the astrological charts with the filmic work of many diverse talents, directors, screenwriters, and actors. We're essentially pairing astrology with film, which doesn't seem like too much of a stretch because Hollywood, I don't know, it's sort of typical or stereotypical to think that actors, directors, all of Hollywood is guided by their astrology. I don't know. Maybe that's being out of turn, but
no, I don't think it is at all. We actually, for some inspiration for this podcast, I picked up this book and it's called The Interface of Movies, Myth, and Archetype. And their big premise about the two subjects is that every movie, no matter what the time or who the director is, contains archetypes in some regard, in some form. And that's what astrology is. It's the study of different archetypes. And so linking them together, it is a pretty natural relationship.
Yeah. And I mean, astrology is another way to tell stories about ourselves, or it creates some sort of narrative framework for us to live our lives. Like, oh, this is what I should be doing today. It creates some sort of story that you can, I'm Scully here because I'm the skeptic a little bit and you're the believer in it. And I think that there's truth to it. And I mean, that's what we're diving into and comparing how I'm going to be looking at the film analysis part of it. Michelle, our wise sage, you know, was guiding us through these stars and charts. Obviously, you know, she picked up the book and we're looking at the astrological chart of a director specifically today. I won't be so much an expert in that, but we're going to be sharing ideas back and forth and seeing how they actually still link up in a way. It's very much auteur theory. We're looking at how a film by a director, by and large, it's accepted that it's actually about the director, him or herself.
You know, you can learn a lot about yourself through astrology. You can learn a lot about somebody through the art that they create. So that's exactly what we're going to be trying to do, is kind of have those two paths line up.
Yeah, hopefully learn something about ourselves along the way, but mostly learn about the geniuses behind the camera or the dummies.
Exactly.
No. It's all in super good fun and yeah, just a great way to connect deeper with films that you might already know. That we know intimately or might be new for both of us or something. And
so today we're talking, as you mentioned, Steven Spielberg. Yeah. I guess you should kind of preface this one that this is kind of our primer episode.
Yeah. We're going to look at five films that hopefully who's ever listening has already seen. We're going to be taking a look at 1974's The Sugarland Express. It's his first one. He's like almost, you're like, he's 24 at the time.
It's ridiculous.
Which is, people talk about Spielie like he was just sort of born into, he like grew up knowing the English language and then the film language. It's just sort of like a native tongue. He was directing them as a bit of a bio into how he got started into film. He was a shy loner, self-described loner in school that didn't really fit in. He talks about how he was always the one picked last. You know, oh, poor you, Spielberg, the most successful filmmaker of all time. But, you know, he's for sure, he grew up and he had a bit of a traumatic childhood with, oh, what, divorce as a big, huge thing. And if that wasn't obvious, you know, take a look at all the absent fathers in all of his movies. And the mothering, you know, nurturing, which is obviously what we're all going to get into. You know, those big themes in these movies that then play out in astrology too. But anyway, sidetracked. Yeah, so he got his start truly in the industry after making, you know, student films, which were his outlet, feeling like a loner. It was his way to escape bullies and being left out of a lot of group activities. That was his world to control. And he's talked about it was his great escape, you know, making movies. So it's always been such a cathartic, therapeutic way to express himself and sort of create his own little worlds that he then shares with, you know, billions of people afterwards. But, you know, growing up out of that in Ohio, he gets his start truly in the industry at the age of 21. And he's doing a TV show in 1969, the pilot episode of the show, Night Gallery, written by Rod Serling. And then it was starring Joan Crawford. Biggie, huge. And I just a quote here was that Crawford was speechless and horrified by the thought of a 21-year-old newcomer directing her. And then was just like, why was this happening to me? But she talks about he was a young genius. He had this intuition, this inspiration. I mean, at such a young age, he could direct, you know, these mega stars and everything. But even at 30 years old, he was such a good director with kids too. And he had no kids himself. So he's just really, I mean, he's the big sentimental bleeding heart, but he connects to people so well. That's such a big part of his career. That's such a big part of his films about connection. So yeah, turning that all back around, the films that we're going to be talking about, none of his student films, none of his TV work. We're going to look at 1974's The Sugarland Express, his debut, 1975's Jaws, 1977's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. We're skipping right past 1941 in 1979. It's a garbage movie.
Oh, it careful.
That's not a hot take. It's a hot piece of garbage. That's the hot take. The hot take is taking it out of the trash.
Oh, no.
Not out of the trash. Yeah, out of the trash and into your DVD player. No, taking it to the trash. It sucks.
Oh, my goodness.
But we're all about love and self-discovery on this podcast. No, not hot takes. We're skipping right over that. And then we're going to 1981's Raiders, 1982's E.T. All these movies are not pieces of garbage.
Wonderful.
And they're a really good, almost we're doing a bit more of a deep dive into these five movies more than Spielberg himself. It's harder to get a big portrait of someone who's had over 35 or something movies. He's just a monster when it comes to the amount of movies he's made. So this is a good example of young Spielberg, but then also sort of the core of his ideals. And we don't get to look at when he sort of drops in the 80s, comes back big with Schindler's List, and then drops sometime, you know, a decade after. So he's got many ups and downs. He's in like his fourth phase of his career,
yeah.
Honestly. So this is his first one, sort of easing into a second one once E.T. is the biggest movie ever. So anyhow, let's get to the astrology side. I've talked enough.
Absolutely.
I feel like, yeah.
I think with that note too, it's important to kind of mention that because astrology is kind of an endless world of possibility,
right.
There's so many different things you can look into and nuggets you can pick out of someone's birth chart, and then looking at the time a movie was released in general too, there's more you can pick out there. So because we're doing five movies, because it would be, there's not a lot of time to give them each the space they deserve, it's going to be a more general overview of his birth chart and how that connects to each of the five movies.
And we'll detail it, but we have three key themes. We have three just buzzwords that we'll keep mentioning over and over, and it will start sounding weird when you keep saying them over and over.
But it'll be great.
But we have three main themes that we're going to be looking at across the five movies, and it's a great way to just chain all these movies together. And yeah, give you a bit of a portrait of the astrological intuition, creative filmic side of a monster like Spielberg, and get them a little closer to your heart.
Oh, the more interviews.
Except 1949 or 41, which is a piece of trash. Sorry, what were you saying?
I was going to say, I've never watched, you know, many Spielberg interviews, but what a cutie.
Now, still?
He's great.
When he doesn't wear his hat, so you can see he's balding a little bit. When he's when he's not wearing, oh, he has like seven kids or something.
He really does. But let's get into his birth chart. So Spielberg was born December 18th, 1946 in Cincinnati, Ohio, United States. There's a lot in Spielberg's birth chart that speaks to his creative nature, first and foremost. His sun is in Sagittarius in the sixth house. So Sagittarius, it's kind of the sign of adventure. He's curious, he's independent, he's eager to push boundaries and define himself through his work. And I think that sign is very much in harmony with his Mars, which is in Capricorn in the sixth house. So he's, I think you can speak more to this, but he's kind of like created the structure and he's like the king of the blockbuster, really, which,
yeah. The architect.
Exactly.
If we want to be pretentious about it.
And yeah. Especially a lot of these movies, like even just taking a look at Jaws, but his most dominant house is the fifth, which is the house of creativity, pleasure, and entertainment. It's also the house that kind of tackles or focuses on children, which we'll talk about later. His Venus Jupiter is also conjunct in the fifth house, which is another just a great sign for creativity, pretty much. So I think we can go over a few aspects of his chart before jumping into the key themes of the movies that we'll be talking about. So his Sagittarius is representative of the types of movies he makes, specifically the ones we're talking about today. So it's a sign that's defined by adventure, exploration, take a look at E.T. or Close Encounters. When I first thought about those few movies, I kind of thought that that would be a sign that's representative with aliens and otherworldly beings of like a Neptune. But I think just the idea of that restless pursuit of truth and seeking the unknown is really present on a more mundane level in Sagittarius. His sun is also in opposition with Uranus in Gemini in the 12th house, which is a great indicator for his interest in otherworldly beings. Uranus specifically is kind of what lends an out-of-this-world quality to a lot of his movies.
Yeah. And what would that mean on a ground level? If they're on CoStar, this astrology app, what is that going to say on a Saturday morning to be like, you deserve an adventure? Like, are they going to say that? Yeah.
No. So I think like, you actually, funny enough, you touched on that a bit when you were kind of talking about Spielberg's background. So your sun is your ego, Sagittarius. So he's eager for adventure. But with the Uranus aspect along with that, it's kind of this idea of wanting to rebel or always wanting to go your own way and stand out and standing out through your uniqueness.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. And he's so career driven. We were talking previously about how his some of that work that he did in school, like remaking Godzilla films and remaking John Ford movies that he saw. You said that later on in his life, he considers that part of his early career. It's not like his career started 100%. With not Night Moves, geez, Night Gallery.
He's basically just said that he's so passionate about it and he works so hard in his early days that he doesn't want to write that off as just, you know, hobby work.
It's adorable.
That even as a 12, he says, my career started when I was 12. Like we mentioned, his dominant house is his fifth, which represents creativity and entertainment as well as children, which we'll talk about later. So it's, in that, it's so clear that he's driven by this creative force in his life that's resulted in so many movies. As well as that, taking a look at Sun and Uranus, he has a T-square with that Sun Uranus, as well as his midheaven, which is in Pisces. So your midheaven kind of...
The purgatory?
I don't know. Oh, no.
Okay. Wrong subject. No. What podcast is this?
So your midheaven kind of defines your success in life, and it's a good indicator of your work. So his midheaven is in Pisces, which means that it's more difficult for people with their midheaven in Pisces to kind of divide their private life from their work. It means that their private, most intimate emotions are often reflected in that work. So with the T-square, exactly, the sun, Uranus, and opposition, and then you have the midheaven in there as well. So that's just a perfect summary of that restless exploration and adventure with the need to stand out with Uranus, and then how that's directly connected to his path in regards to work.
Yeah, just hearing that, it's funny because I just wonder, you know, Spielberg knows himself better than anyone, or maybe his wife does or something, but thinking of how he started his career at 12 years old or something, and that it was his outlet, you know, making these movies, these you know, DIY movies, sci-fi, Western. I mean, they're all, they're in this HBO bio I watched a while ago or something. Yeah, just considering that it's all part of his career, or he considers it part of his career. I just wonder if there's ever a Spielberg that exists before he just knew film was the thing, because we know him as the film guy. And I just wonder how much of he knows himself as the film guy. He just gets wrapped up in career. Like, it's just all career, and he stands out and he like creates himself as part of his films. And it's, you know, some people can really exist outside of their films. And Spielberg just inhabits them entirely. And there's pull quotes I've talked about, even E.T., where he just said, it's not good to fall in love with your own movies, but I fell in love with E.T. Mm-hmm. And just all that kind of stuff. You could just see how he has such a passion for it. He still does. He's a great role model for anyone who's just wants to sink themselves into anything that they love. You know, that's, this could happen for you or whatever.
Yeah.
So, extremely positive right now. I don't know why. 1941 sucks. That movie sucks. Okay. So we've done a little bit of the overview. I think it's worth just jumping right in. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds good.
So the first theme we're going to talk about, the first buzzword we got between all these five movies is communication.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing I picked out is his Mercury, also in Sagittarius, in the sixth house, which is the house of service and work. So communication is a theme in all of his movies. His Mercury is also in Sagittarius, in the house of service and work. So he really uses that communication as a theme in his work, tying to that idea of adventure. The two other things I kind of picked out, I was looking at his Mercury specifically, of course, because Mercury is the planet of communication. So his natal Mercury is trine Pluto in Leo in the second house. So what I kind of understood from that is just taking a look at E.T. specifically is the one that kind of spoke to me with this, is him using communication as a solution almost, or as a tool in transformative situations. Communication is something that's very transformative, or can be, if it's used properly or not. So that's where the Pluto kind of comes into play. His natal Mercury is also sextile Neptune in Libra.
What is sextile?
It's just a harmonious relationship. So you have disharmonious relationships between planets, depending on their aspect. And sextile is just one that doesn't provide the most harmony, but it's definitely a cohesive relationship between the planets, right? Neptune kind of has qualities of dreams and mysticism. It's in the fourth house, which is the house of home and relationships. So kind of similar to the previous point of, you know, communication being transformative, is communication also being transcendent.
Yeah.
Okay.
I got goodies for that.
You do. I know you do.
We have been. We've been. Notes. Everyone, we've been communicating about these points.
I think also what's important to note.
That was almost as bad as 1941. Spielberg's movie from 1971.
I think we can also hop back to his Sun Uranus opposition. So Uranus, besides just being kind of a planet of rebellion and upheaval and change, is a lot of it often relates to technological innovation. As a tool of communication, I think looking at just those early movies, Jaws to E.T., the use of aliens and special effects, from a technological standpoint, innovative special effects and technology is something that, whether it's at the forefront of the movie, like in
Close Encounters,
or it's not, but it's still present, like in E.T., where he's still really using technology as a tool to communicate a message.
Yeah, and I mean, even just a profound wherewithal and control of it, because, I mean, famously, this is not blowing anyone's minds, but the Jaws shark didn't work.
Yeah.
And then he jokes about, there's a really cute thing where they're traveling the universe a lot, which is basically his backyard. It might as well just be his backyard full of artifacts of his early career. In the mid-90s or something, just before Jurassic Park comes out, I think. And he's like, well, the Jaws shark works now. It works for the paying customers, not for when I wanted to use it in the film. And so, but that's the thing of just like a complete understanding of it, where it's like, okay, well, it's not working, but we can cut around it, or we'll show less of it. Mm-hmm. So it's still, even when the technology is not working, let's say, mm-hmm. he knows how to communicate with it. He knows how to make the film around it and work around it. So talking about communication in his films for the first theme. So if we can start with Sugarland Express, if you haven't seen Sugarland, it is based on a true story of these two teenagers who break out of prison. And there was a massive pileup of police officers just following them in the middle of Texas. And it takes place and it was shot in the middle of Texas. It's got a great performance from Goldie Hawn, mid-70s.
Yeah.
He talks about how he wanted to pick her because, you know, she was funny and there needed to be a really colorful, bright, orchestral performance in a comedic sense, but then a lot of sort of deep regret, or there was something underlying that was just not necessarily sitting well with the character as well. You know, she's been to prison. Their kid has been taken away from them by the state. So they're up against the law. They're up against all these police officers following them. And there's a bunch of communication in the film on walkie-talkies. So if we're talking about tech, I thought of it, you know, I don't know if you put it down, but the walkie-talkies can remind someone of childhood.
Yeah,
when you're, right. And the third thing we're going to be talking about is childhood. You don't even have the second theme yet. 1, 3, 2. But they're communicating through walkie-talkies primarily in the film because they've taken one of the cops hostage. They've taken their car and they're going to get their kid that's been taken away by child services because, you know, they're in jail and they've committed crimes. And they mentioned there's a crime. I can't remember what it was, you know, petty larceny or something.
Sure,
and,
yeah.
You know, I might have been. Not even drug deals or something. It's a Spielberg movie, so it's PG. We're not really getting that much details.
Small.
So they're trying to get the kid back, and they're going on this big, it's just a big road trip movie. It's a race movie. And it's a great start to his career, obviously. But for me, when I was looking at it, you know, it's an example of failed communication because, spoiler alert, the husband, who I'm blanking on the name right now and I'll look up, but Lou Jean, who is Goldie Hawn's character, the husband dies and she doesn't end up in jail. She probably ends up in jail.
Yeah, nothing's
ever. They do a lot of naughty. Yeah. they do some dirty work in that movie for sure. But let me look up the character. So Clovis, you know, you can maybe forgive me for not remembering that garlic Clovis name. So Clovis and Lou Jean Poplin. So it's an example of failed communication. There's a scene that really illustrates this in the middle of the movie where the police chief actually gets Lou Jean's father to try to talk some sense into her. Now, she's not even in the car, and the cop that they've taken hostage hears it only. But he talks about how she's failed as a mother, mm-hmm. and if I had a gun, I'll shoot you myself and everything like that. You know, threatening her. Mm-hmm. It's really sad, and that's like the turning point of that movie for sure, where you see how she hasn't come from a good childhood or anything like that. And it's just the failed communication between her father and her mother, you know, likely not being able to raise her properly. So it's an example of failed communication, though, and that communication primarily, you know, the walkie-talkies with the tech and the negotiations to get their kid back, it fails. They don't get their kid back. It's an oddly downtrodden ending for Spielberg, but it's still, communication still is prevalent nonetheless.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think between these five movies, I think throughout the first half of the five we've picked, it does show communication in that, not a negative light, but definitely a
failed light.
Exactly.
Which is bizarre to think about the rest of his career, because as we're going to get to in Jaws, you have a lot of scenes. So visually, you know, cinematography, editing, and dialogue wise, when they're at the town hall and they're discussing how the hell they're going to get rid of the shark, mm-hmm. you have eight to 10 city council members all in one shot. It's this nice deep focus. He's taking it from Orson Welles, you know, Citizen Kane style. It's got like 8 to 10 people and a lot of the cities there, and they're having this town hall, you know, open town hall meeting to try to talk about how they're going to get rid of it. What's the bounty they're going to put up on the shark? And I mean, if the soundtrack didn't have, I don't know, the technical limitations at that point, but like everyone is trying to talk over each other in that scene. And again, it's this failed communication. They're all fighting to be heard.
Right.
So they're trying to communicate this idea. And again, communication is going to start sounding weird for everyone listening. But they're in effect, they're fighting to fit in the frame visually. Mm-hmm. So cinematography wise, you know, it matches this theme of communication. Mm-hmm. And I'm just talking, you know, film, concrete stuff where there's 8 people in the shot, but there's 8 people trying to be heard in the shot. So it links with the communication theme. You know, they're trying to solve this solution. It's this transformation, you know, it's this transformation, as you've talked about.
It's a transformation, but it has, in Jaws, as well as in Sugarland, Back to Pluto, it really has, honestly, life or death repercussions.
Absolutely. Fails communication, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And I mean, there's a failure to communicate the extremity of the situation, mm-hmm. how dangerous this shark will be. And the mayor, who's only focused on economics and making money for the town,
mm-hmm.
he's a capitalist. You know, he wants, you know, it's summer season, it's their season. He talks about how Amityville needs money. Is that the name of the town? Doesn't matter.
Amityville.
Yeah, I think so.
Amity,
right?
Beach.
Yeah. Amity Beach. Did the murders happen there as well? Is Ryan Reynolds in that movie, the remake? Have you seen that before?
No.
Me neither.
Nice.
So we don't know if Ryan Reynolds is in that movie. No, so he's focused on that, but I think it's a huge part of it, and I think it also links up with probably a lot of the citizens too, is that they're not concerned about the money necessarily coming in, while he is. They're also just concerned about the idyllic nature of the whole town. Like, it's just the pristine, beautiful beach. It's also just America at large, where it's like, we're going to deny that anything's happening. If we're using it as a microcosm for like the States, where you just deny, and like you just ignore that anything bad could possibly happen,
right,
until it bites your kid in half and then you have the mourning mother. You know, so that's exactly the failure to communicate in that film. And again, you have a bunch of other shots continuously where it's a lot of one takes, just lovely use of fitting in 5 to 6 shots without cutting at all.
Mm-hmm.
But they keep going between characters that are trying to fill up the frame because they're trying to get their idea across.
Right. And in that, it seems that communication is something that's very much in harmony in Spielberg's birth chart. He understands it, which is why he uses it as a tool so often.
Yeah.
So in that failed communication, his portrayal of it as a tool and its failure is really just representative of his mastery of it as an idea.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing with the, even just going to the tech of just knowing like this shark didn't work. This movie's also 45 years old, isn't it? 75. Am I doing math? Oh boy. Definitely 45. It's 45. Yeah.
Yeah.
and it's still effective. We watched it 2 weeks ago or something together, and it's still good.
It's
I still
great.
Get tense, but you know, so it works really well.
Absolutely.
It holds up. So yeah. And just kind of still sticking on Jaws, because there's so many themes to it, and they will start linking up,
mm-hmm.
with, spoiler alert, childhood,
mm-hmm.
and adulthood and fatherhood and everything. This movie does not. This movie has Roy Scheider killing it as the dad, killing it as the police chief, because he's not an absent father. It's a really rare occurrence where the role is really infused with a lot of protection for the family. Or he really knows, like he's just trying to deny himself of the mistake of moving from New York City, which the wife, Ellen, sort of brings up, that they're like, it's time to go. And it's just like back home to New York City or whatever.
Right.
But no, like he wants to prove himself to his family, and he wants to protect his family, obviously. And the last one, though, that I'll talk about for Jaws and that communication, which then will perfectly link up with Close Encounters,
right,
which is a weird sort of bridge between failed and successful communication and the transcendence,
yeah,
where Dreyfus, Richard Dreyfus, just becomes adopted by aliens.
Oh,
spoiler alert.
Precious.
Again, if you haven't seen it. Precious, but also abandons his family, so absent father. Again, so many themes all linking up, like literally one action of like, the absent father who's abandoned his family. I'm getting ahead of myself, but the absent father, but the absent father getting away from his family. But if I can just hinge on Jaws just for a second more, and it will link really nicely to Close Encounters, the next one coming up.
Mm-hmm.
In both the editing, dialogue, and cinematography, for this nonverbal communication at the dinner table, and Spielberg loves dinner table scenes.
Yeah,
it's a great way to show the truth and sort of the dynamics of a family that he's always so focused on. There's a really lovely scene where Roy Scheider, or Brody, the police chief, the character Brody's son, is miming him. He's sort of putting his hands together. He's, you know, rubbing his face, looking up to his father. It's a tender moment, but it is without verbally communicating it, without having some dumb kind of dialogue. Brody just sort of embodies the stress. He's got the weight of trying to protect his family from this man-eating shark on his shoulders, and he's stressed as hell. And his son can pick up on that, and his son is miming that. It's a tender moment where it shows the stress of that. It's communicating this, right? But non-verbally, it's communicating the stress of Brody's task and also just how close he is to his son. And his son looks up to him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's stress and affection all coming together. And then that is completely opposed in Close Encounters. I mean, you've never seen it. It was Michelle's first time watching this movie.
Like, I don't know how.
Well, I've referenced, like, I've played with my potatoes at the dinner table as a joke, and it didn't it didn't communicate because I'm not a Spielberg. Like, what were your first impressions having the context of it, like that potato scene? For reference, if anyone isn't seeing it, I recommend you go to YouTube or something, but aliens have landed and only a few chosen few have seen the UFO, and then when they interact with it, all they can see, which it happens to be the Devil's Tower in Wyoming, this actual landmark, but they just keep trying to make this mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And he's making the mountain and everything he sees, the shaving cream, his potatoes later in the movie. Like, what was your impression of it? Like, what did you think about it?
Well, the first time you had kind of showed me the scene out of context on YouTube, and it's
still works, by the way.
It's
no,
it's
like, maybe it doesn't. Maybe it doesn't.
It comes across as kind of like comical, honestly. It's this man playing with his potatoes. But
yeah,
when you see it in the movie in the context of him sitting across from his son, and his son's watching him and starts crying as he's building up these potatoes.
Because
it's so indicative of kind of how his father's honestly slipping away.
Yeah.
His mental state's deteriorating. And then his drive for finding this actual mountain and the source.
And I mean, if it's just focusing on the father, it's like midlife crisis. The movie.
Yeah.
But it's a really traumatic thing. It's like someone's psychological breakdown is happening or something.
Right.
So,
yeah.
And I mean, it's working in Close Encounters. I mean, Richard Dreyfuss, it's a happy ending for the father.
Yeah, absolutely.
And but then going back to that conflict and having a profound understanding of it, Spielberg talks about E.T. as a movie of divorce. It's his divorce movie where he is cathartically dealing with it and expressing that and communicating that idea, because as a child of divorce, you know, the father is completely absent. And that is spoken blatantly in that movie. But I almost see Close Encounters as a prologue or the prequel to E.T. because they're both alien movies. And in Close Encounters, the father leaves. He literally abandoned. Well, the wife takes the kids and they go to the sisters. But in the middle of the movie, once the aliens have landed and they've abducted another woman's son, and there's a group of them that are sort of looking to the night sky, trying to find answers, and they keep seeing this mountain image, and he goes mad, but he completely, like, he loses his job, he gets fired, he doesn't seem to care, and he's completely absent as a father. There's that conflict in real life where he, up until later on in Spielberg's life, when his parents actually reunited and ended up happily, you know, together, until the unfortunate passing of his mom a few years ago. But the dad was the villain, you know, the dad was absent, he left and everything like that. So that always is there. So in Close Encounters, Richard Dreyfuss's character is almost, I think, the father in E.T. And that conflict, right? It's the family after the fact. And then the son has a void there, but then the son is starting to interact with aliens. Yeah, but just linking these dinner scenes, it's a great father versus absent father. Mm-hmm. And it's profound. Like, I mean, I think they both got potatoes. Richard Dreyfuss is eating potatoes as Hooper, he's eating the potatoes and then he's playing with them in the next one. Right. But besides those dinner scenes, the communication comes across between, I mean, even in the in media res opening, there's a lot of cross wires. At the very end, there's an American translating a Mexican to François Truffaut, who's a Frenchman.
Right, yeah.
You know, and they're all translating these ideas and what they've seen and everything like that. And I think it's very closely tied both in Close Encounters and E.T., which mm-hmm. I think are just this sort of diptych. Just these two sister movies always generating the same sort of ideas and themes, where it's always multiple translations of language, mm-hmm. Which clearly I couldn't communicate right now. But it happens with, there's this beautiful end to the movie where the aliens and the humans are communicating through music. Five tones, D, E, C, C, G are the notes. And it's five tones, and that's the language they're talking. That's mm-hmm. the music. It's just sound, you know, and noise. But those are the words they're speaking of, peace and harmony. Mm-hmm. And earlier in the movie, before they get to that mountain and before they start talking through the music, there is a radio transmission that they keep receiving, that the government agents keeps receiving. And those numbers actually just end up being coordinates to the aforementioned Devil's Tower in Wyoming. And it's a brilliant conversation between alien and human through music and sound, and also understanding that the language of these numbers is actually sort of directions, right? It's all just translating ideas. And in a large way, this is what we're doing, you know, with his films as well. So
for sure. And even just beyond, you know, traditional modes of communication, it's back to that Sun Uranus opposition with communication, as his Uranus is in Gemini. It's as they're in opposition, it's almost as if technology is initially, you know, a boundary to that in Close Encounters specifically, yeah. But it does all come together. And once it's working harmoniously, then that's when you achieve
transcendence. Exactly. It's all the three things that we said before, you know, communicating these ideas through technology, the technology of the radio transmissions, and the technology of, you know, the walkie-talkies, et cetera, all throughout these movies. And it's a solution, though. So his problem, let's say, in Close Encounters, his problem is, what the hell is this mountain?
Yeah.
And how do I just – his solution to, like, a transformative experience and transformative situation is that he's been – his mind has been abducted by aliens, essentially, and for the mother as well. Her kid's been abducted by aliens. And he's then allowed, through technology, you know, through the music, that communication – through the technology, he's allowed transcendence because he aboards the spaceship at the end with these two little alien babies.
And even E.T., the scene where he's, besides E.T. almost being like technology, not in his actual creation, but just some otherworldly being.
E.T.?
Yeah.
But I mean, even the process of, because he's real, you know, he's robotics.
But his whole, you know, quest to use the pieces from the home to kind of create that device that will
so cute
that'll kind of help him talk to his family.
Yeah, like let's say it was like Michael's movie. Let's say it wasn't Elliot's; it was like more of a teen movie. Mm-hmm. Michael's a bit of an asshole. Let's say like he's just, you know, he's making fun of Elliot at the beginning. Do you mm-hmm. think he would have just like patted E.T. on the head, be like, "That's cute"? Like he's like too dumb to get that he's trying to go home or something. You know what I mean?
You might be right.
Another question, the better joke that I have mm-hmm. is that I've always thought that like, oh, you just wonder like, oh, what if E.T. didn't go home? Would he just be like chilling for 20 years and then he would just be fixing like Wi-Fi routers for Bell? He'd just work for Verizon and he'd be in the commercials as this like genius alien. But he would just go like door to door. He would still like, he'd be like unshaven.
The studio was really pushed for Spieli to make a second one. And wasn't he just wasn't he just like, that doesn't make any sense?
Well, he said in the end,
was he going to do a comeback?
I know.
What's he going to do?
I know. He interacts with Close Encounters, Richard Dreyfuss. He goes, homie, how are those potatoes treating you? I think that's about it for communication. We've really gone deep into this, too deep, honestly.
One might say.
One might say. But I not to skim over anything, but not to not touch on Raiders. This is the thing. This is my golden nugget that I was just thinking of, is that the Ark of the Covenant. So Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Nazis, Hitler himself, he wants the Ark of the Covenant, which is basically the artifact that's in that would have held the Ten Commandments, and it's a sacred item. And if used properly and found, he could maybe possibly destroy armies, and his army would use it to very evil uses. I haven't told you this, but Ark of the Covenant is the ancient dangerous technology that would allow for true transcendence, because who are you communicating with? God.
Whoa.
Yeah, you're communicating with ghosts and past lives and everything. So essentially, the Nazis transcend to their death at the end of the movie. But it's true is that they're trying to discover and find, which is that sense of adventure that really drives him. Mm-hmm. And the career of Indy is just to preserve, you know, he's trying to stop the Nazis from getting this technology that would allow you to transcend and communicate with God. It really comes together. Yeah, it's almost like the simplest one, but it's hidden behind all this genre and the adventure and everything like that. And you're just distracted by the amazing Nazi costume. That's so awesome. I can't really tell. But yeah, it's even in that one too. As much as we both kind of didn't think that, the golden nugget got cooked before we touched it down on recording. Yeah, so just to pass over it really briefly, that was it. So they're all five are worked together.
I do have one nugget, though, with communication, which I thought was cool.
Give me the nug.
Spielberg, talking with communication for Close Encounters, typically one's Mercury return doesn't seem as significant as some of the outer planets, because Mercury's return happens more frequently. But with communication, he experienced his full Mercury return on November 14th, 1977, which was only a day before the release of Close Encounters.
Whoa.
That's kind of cool.
Wait, so what would that mean again?
So you're returning.
I was totally listening. I am too dumb to get some of this.
No. It's okay. So your returns, it's when the planet returns to the position it was at your birth.
Oh.
Right. So your inner planets, you experience their return more frequently.
Right, of course.
But some of the outer planets, like Saturn, takes almost 30 years. So they're more significant because they don't happen as often. But each return is supposed to be kind of a significant event with the qualities of the planet that's returning. So Mercury is the planet of communication. So you know when Mercury's in retrograde, everyone freaks out because it's supposed to be just like miscommunication, and it's supposed to cause a lot of havoc because communication's not working in harmony in our lives.
But it returning, sort of something is completed.
Exactly. Exactly.
So he might have, through the whole process, the father was unable to communicate. but he almost found his home. He found his purpose. Right. Which he says directly. Yes. Which apparently is being abducted by aliens. So this is the end of part one of our Spielberg Fiverr Primer.
Yeah.
During the recording, we didn't really realize
how long
we were going to talk for. We got real passionate about this stuff. So we're cutting this up into two. At the beginning, we said we were going to talk about three themes, but we actually ended up just getting through
one.
His bio and probably his one.
Yeah.
We'll see how this gets caught up. For the next episode, whenever that comes out soon, we'll be discussing the two other themes. So I spoiled the one, which is the third theme, talking about childhood. The second one we're going to be talking about is the polarization of good and evil. Sit with that, sleep on it, take what
you will.
Whatever you think about that. That's what we're going to talk about for the five movies next week, our next episode,
basically.
Yeah, we don't really know the schedules. But those movies, again, to watch them, Sugarland Express, Jaws, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
That without blinking.
I also did that without thinking about how wordy most of those titles are.
Yeah.
Jaws. That's why, you know. So I hope you enjoy part one. That's the end.
We'll see you later.
We'll see you in part two. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.